Hello and welcome to the Massachusetts Farm to Table podcast, where we explore the fields, kitchens, and stories that make the Massachusetts food scene so special. I'm your host, Nissa Gadbois. Each week, we'll connect with farmers, food producers, and the community that makes the Commonwealth's food scene so vibrant. Join me as we meet the passionate farmers, food producers, and chefs who are shaping the farm-to-table movement right here in Massachusetts. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Massachusetts Farm-to-Table podcast. This week, I'm sitting down with Jody Jess of Buckhill Farm Homestead in Westminster, where she milks a herd of Kerry cattle. We talk about raw milk, cow genetics, and natural beekeeping, as well as the costs of small farming. It's a delightful interview, a little bit longer than normal, so grab your favorite beverage and a snack and settle in for this episode of the Massachusetts Farm to Table podcast. Hi, Jody. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Nissa. Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you here. Can you start by telling us a little bit about your farm and how you get started?
So I am a fourth generation farmer. I own 4.5 acres here. I use some of my grandparents' old dairy farmland that is owned by my cousin. So I'm really only on 4.5 acres here. My neighbors are very helpful in letting me use their old cornfields, their old hay fields, and I make my own hay. I graze the dry cows and the steers down at the end of the road at an old farm that my girlfriend that lives on the next street purchased, just to keep it open. And I got started with Dexter cattle, and I was milking them. There wasn't that many people milking them. And I just couldn't make a full batch of cheese with one milking. So I had my mentor in New York called Sean Ann Lord, Someday Maybe Farm, and she said, you need Kerry cows. So that my journey began with Kerry cows. It took me 3 years to find my first Kerry cow that was for sale. And I just fell in love. And my mission basically started as preservation of an extremely, almost extinct, rare breed, where globally there's only 250 left.
Really? I didn't know they were that rare.
Oh, yes. And 65 are housed right now in the USA. When I first got into them, if there were 25, you were lucky. Wow. So they're extremely rare. Their milk is very unique. It's a lot like goat's milk, where the fat goblin is very, very small. Mm-hmm. So it's easy to digest. And the fat don't raise up. They have plenty of fat, and I test for that so I know who is more fatty than others. You can do that with DNA. And they're the original grass-fed milk cow. They were the first cow that people actually went to Killarney, Ireland, and Kaukauna Kerry, and got their Kerry cow as their house cow, milk cow. And that's the story of them. So that set me on the mission of they need to be milked, because nobody was milking them. They were all in museums and places like that. So I started milking them, and, you know, I always wanted to open a raw dairy. Never thought I could, being so small. And, you know, when my girlfriend bought the farm down at the end of the road, we were going to put it there, but the electrical was so bad, it would have been too much money. So my husband said, let's do it here. So then I got a hold of my inspector. She came here. She's like, yeah, you can do it here. Right. So we took part of my hay storage in my tractor port and put a 3-cow step up in there. We made our own step ups out of cement, big cement blocks. And I made the milk house is actually portable. I can put it on the back of my truck and take it with me. It's totally self-contained. And I can even milk a cow in the back if I really want to, do one at a time. But it was mostly that part of it was mostly for education of new farmers to see, you know, you can lease a farm and move, because most do, and take your biggest asset with you, which is your milk house.
That's a great
And you get,
idea.
and they can be up and running within their inspector coming out and inspecting it wherever it's landed.
Oh, that's so cool. I would love to see that.
You're welcome to come. Anybody's welcome to come see it. Anybody interested? My whole basis for this at 62 is education of younger or older farmers that want to add a value product to their farm as raw milk. I'm happy to do that. That's why I did that project.
That's amazing. So tell me about carries. I know Dexters are small. Are carries also very small?
They are. The females are between 750 and 650. They're small. I had to customize like my the side so they didn't fall through them, like a whole, because they're made for a Holstein, not a carry cow. So a lot of stuff is customized for their size, and most things aren't like anti-kicks aren't made for carry cows, they're made for Holstein. So we have to put a pool noodle under them to hold them up so they clamp on the right part of the leg, you know. So there's a lot of unique things you have to adjust, but it all in the end works. So I also don't pull my calves. I calf share, which I was told you can't do with dairy cows, you know, because of, you know, causing mastitis or whatever. We check that every day on every cow and we monitor it very strictly. And we have not had a problem doing that.
So, for folks who don't know, sort of customers that might be listening, can you explain calf share?
So calf share is when the mother's still feeding the calf, providing me milk to bottle for my customers. And it's a more natural way. And it's easier when they're weaned. So they start out there with their calf 24/7. We milk whatever they got. And then they go back in with their calves. And about 3 to 4 weeks, depending on what they're eating and how they're growing, then the mother will go out during the day, come in and get milked. We save some. They always save some because they're heritage breeds, so they hold back pretty good. And then they go in with their calf at night and the calf drinks. So calf sharing is a way a lot of homesteaders do it, because either they want to be able to do other things and not milk, or be able to have that little flexibility of the calf able to drink out the mother.
Right.
So, and that's how I started as a homesteader, you know, and then I moved into, you know, deciding to open a licensed dairy and sell to the public instead of just for me.
You mentioned that you were a fourth generation farmer in the same on the same property, or
Yes, on the same property. The story was when I was the first grandchild to get married, so my grandparents, I was looking for a house and wanted some land, and my grandmother was like, "We got all this land, we're not doing anything," because they were of age at that point. And why don't you build here? I rather keep the family together. And my parents live right down the road, my sister lives right down the road, so, and my cousin lives down the road, so we're all on here. The property's still pretty much all connected still, so.
that's great. So what kind of farming did your grandparents do?
Dairy farming.
Still dairy. So you had a lot
Both
of
sides.
experience
Yeah.
with dairy to
Yeah.
begin
My
with.
other grandparents live right, but my name of my farm is Buck Hill Homestead Farm. My other grandparents were on the other side of Buck Hill. And as kids, we used to take our ponies over there,
Oh.
you know. So, and they're in Fitchburg, so I abut Fitchburg. And so that's, you know, and my grandfather and his parents farmed that same farm also.
Specimens.
And they came in from Germany, and I don't even know. It was in the late 1600s, I believe, when they came here.
Wow.
So,
So you're from a very old family here.
yes, yes. And I always say Darien's in your blood, whether you think it is or not, or you can't find where it is. I believe it's in there. Because it's definitely a passion, that you want to do dairying.
You mentioned that you do raw milk dairy.
Yes, I do raw milk dairy, and
So,
that started because that's what I was doing for my family.
right. So, are the is it more difficult for you to get licensed in Massachusetts if you do raw dairy?
It's not easy. It's not that it's hard either. It's you have to make sure your bacteria counts are and your somatic cell counts and all that has to be a lot lower than selling product to the plant. I'm held to strict regulations, and I'm tested once a month, sometimes twice a month if they're in the area. But usually it's once a month, and that you just say, oh geez, they were here, hopefully I'm doing it right, and you don't know, because I'm hand washing my I put it in glass, and I'm hand washing them, and you got to sanitize them and all that, so it's not that you're not doing it right, but you always question it. Hopefully I did it right, and you got to pass three tests before you get your license. So you got to have three clean tests right in a row. Otherwise, if you have one that doesn't, you have to start all over again for another three, and no one wants to do that.
So the reason that it's allowed that those bacteria and somatic cell counts can be a little bit higher when they're going to the wholesaler is because they're going to be pasteurized anyway. Is that right?
Yes, they're going to pasteurize it, and that kills just about everything in there. So, they're not as concerned as that. We all still get tests for antibiotics. There's no antibiotics allowed in anybody's milk.
Okay.
So,
So, can you talk about the benefits of raw milk for people that still haven't heard?
Well, raw milk has all the bacteria that our gut needs to flourish, and I believe it's a health benefit with to have all those bacteria that we're supposed to have in our gut. Pasteurized milk, it doesn't, because it's pasteurized, heated up, and it kills them, all the bacteria off. Is there a risk to both? Absolutely, but I mean, I've consumed it my whole life. And my son's consumed it, his whole, he went in his bottle, So, it's all in how you read the literature about it. And I think everyone should read about it and read both sides of it, and make their decision on if this is something that they want for their family. But to me, it's a health benefit. My cows are also all tested for A2 milk. So I know what milk I have, and that's supposed to be another health benefit. Is it? I'm not claiming it is, and I'm not claiming that it's not, but I just figured if I can test them and know, I'm gonna know. And that's what I wanted for my family. So everyone has the right to look it up and, make their own decisions.
Explain A2. That has to do with proteins in the milk.
Yes, A2 protein. So the A1 protein only exists in humans and diabetics, believe it or not. I'm diabetic, so I produce A1 milk. So every other mammal produces A2 milk. Cats, dogs, whales, whatever. I guess it's all A2 milk from what I have read. And what it is that they Don't they say the protein broke due to inbreeding? I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what I had read about it. But it is a protein break, and it is in me as a diabetic, a protein break.
So, what does that mean for people that are consuming A2 milk?
So supposedly the A2 milk is it's a on a certain gene, and I think it's a gene they called it. And it's supposed to have health benefits to it if it's not broken. For this histone and histamine, and one is histone, one is histamine, and it's not like the histamine, like allergy histamine, is not that. It's a different thing. So UC Davis has a great e explanation about what, where it is, what it is, and that's where I test my cows. I actually had to become a geneticist with these cows because I have to keep their genetics separated, and so we don't do that to them. And so I learned a lot about genetics and how it works. And you can take an A1 cow and turn it into an A2 cow just with the right breeding.
Yeah.
And it takes a few, if you get an A1 A1, you breed it to an A2 A2, you could get an A2 A2, you're going to get an A1 A2, and then you breed it again, that heifer back to another A2 A2, that A1 might drop off.
So
So,
it's kind of reminding me of my last episode with Terry Lawton, where she was saying how much science is involved in farming, and folks just don't realize how much we do of science.
a farmer's knowledge, you can't even teach that in school because it changes in the snap of a finger. You have to absorb so much, and everyone's like, how do you know that? It's like, oh, I don't know. I guess I had this happen, blah, blah, blah. Like, I got into heritage reads. Now I have to read genetics. I can read genetics and tell you who's milky, who's not. I mean, that's just something I self-trained.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of knowledge in farming that you learn. It's not just, shovel and poop like I do mostly.
We do a lot of that stuff.
Yes.
I tell people it's surprisingly wet farming. You
Yes.
get
Yeah.
wet all the time.
Yeah.
So
Yeah.
you sell liquid milk and what else on your farm?
I sell honey. I have an apiary. My apiary is unique because I don't feed my bees any sugar water. And I did that because I am diabetic type 1, and my first year, of course, that's what they tell you, feed them sugar water. And my sugars would blast up when I ate my own honey. And I was like, I don't think it's supposed to do that.
Right.
And then it clicked. Well, I'm feeding them sugar water. Why wouldn't that honey have that? So I stopped, and it was a lot better. So
Yeah, more science.
more science, and learning. So that was just something I learned. And I learned that, not to put down the big apiaries, because sometimes you do. If I won't let them starve, I'll feed it to them if I have to, but I haven't yet. I just don't get all the honey. I have to keep it aside. Like, I still have 2 boxes left from over winter, and that will be if I do splits or whatever, they'll get that
So
instead
that
of sugar water.
folks who are listening understand that when you're a natural beekeeper, you save back some of the honey that you harvest in case you have to feed it back to them because they use it as food.
Exactly. And that, where I am, preservation again comes into play with that too. I don't always catch my swarms because I'm hoping they go find a tree with a nice hollow trunk that they live for forever.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just the way I farm. It's, everyone does it different. I don't think good or bad of either one. I just know what works for me.
Right. Right.
And everybody finds that in farming. What works for you might not work for somebody else.
Exactly. Yeah, we've talked a lot about that over the first few episodes of the podcast too, where you've got to farm the way that works for what you're doing. And each of us has somewhat unique goals with
Right.
a combination of the livestock, the type of farming we're doing, our family situation, the market situation where we are.
Yes.
So you have milk and honey. Do you sell beef as well?
I sell beef. I just started with lamb again because I got rid of my pigs because they were too close to the dairy because you can't have them too close. So I stopped pig farming. I got a lamb. So she's going to have her first babies and we'll see how that goes. And I also spin and weave and all that. So it's a wool breed.
That's excellent. What breed do you have?
I have Stella. Stella is her name. She is a long wool. She is also rare, and I don't remember, not a Cotswold. Stella is, I didn't write it down and I don't remember what she is. Sorry.
That's
I'll come to me, it just went blank. I knew what it is, but she is another very rare sheep, so I am into the rare breeds.
Yeah, I am too. I love that. So you said you're on the border with Fitchburg. Do you sell only on farm, or do you also go into Fitchburg and
Well,
sell there?
I'm gonna be starting at Fitchburg Market, I think. I was doing Ashburnham Farmers Market, and as everybody knows, the farmers markets are iffy around here. So Ashburnham is not having their market this year. So, I think I might pick up Fitchburg as the market, my next market.
Do you have a lot of support in within your community from folks on the
Yeah, we
farm?
do. Yeah, I have quite a bit of support within my community of as far as people coming in. It's hard because I'm off the beaten path of a, because I'm a farm and in central Mass where land is astronomical, so there's more houses. There's not really farmland, and if there is, it's way out of the way, So, but I do have a steady stream of customers. I'm opening my first farm stand. I've never had a farm stand. I only had in my garage, and my eggs would be out by the road in a cooler. So,
Yeah.
I am getting ready to open a farm stand, so it's more self-serve.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, and they can come get milk and meat and whatever, and I don't have to tend it as much.
Does that go on the honor system? Do they buy it online and then come pick it up? How does that work?
I'm gonna try the honor system first. It should be pretty good. Other than I do have a lot a livestock dog that barks a lot, and everyone's afraid of him, but he's not scary. He just likes to bark.
Well, he's doing his job really
He's doing
well.
his job. He's telling me somebody's here, and that's what he's supposed to do. So,
So, Jody, what kinds of challenges have you faced over the years of farming?
Cost of farming in a small scale. The cost, like everybody else, the costs have skyrocketed, and I still have to buy in hay because I have more cows than I need because I am preservation, and it's hard to give that up. So, like my husband always says, you got too many cows. I'm like, I know, but what do I do? Do I beef them and get rid of that genetic to keep the diversity, or do I, struggle to keep them? So it's the cost. The cost this last year was huge with 2 years of getting wet hay, and
Oh.
the hay cost just exploded. It's just expensive. That's my biggest challenge, is the expense of it. And trying to
We struggled
stay.
last year and we just didn't get any hay in.
They,
We were all struggling to get hay in last year.
everybody, it's across the board. And that's one of the struggles people don't really don't see, and they don't realize. When a bale costs, 10 or more dollars to feed your animals, and it's only 30 pounds. I mean, they used to be at least 45, 50 pound bales. They're not that anymore. So even the round bales, we were weighing them this year. We've got anywhere from 260 pound round bales that are supposed to be 500 or 700 pounds. You
Wow.
know, it's, and I recommend that if any other farmers out there, weigh your hay because it's not what's in there.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's hard to weigh the wet bales because it depends on how wet they are. But, you know, if they're telling you it's 800 pounds, it should be 800 pounds.
Right. Yeah.
Because it's just so expensive. We have to start doing that. We just bought a cheap scale and we hang it off the bucket or off forks.
Because you need to, your animals need a certain amount. So you need to know exactly
Right.
how much is in there so you can calculate how much you need to spend. Oh, it's also
Yeah, it's a
math.
lot that you do, you know. And it's not just me, it's even the people that own horses, you know. I mean, they're paying the premium prices because a lot of people don't feed a lot of, they can't even feed any what we call junk hay, you know, cow hay or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't know how they got a felt it this year.
Yeah. So we've covered science and math now for farmers. Economics, definitely. So
So
you mentioned about your mobile milking room
unit.
unit.
That's what I call it, a little unit.
Unit. And some education stuff you're doing. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
I usually have, you know, once a month, sometimes 2 a month, young people, older people come through. Some are homesteaders that just want to know how to set up a milking parlor or a milk room, or not that they're going to sell milk, but they just want to see how it's done or how a claw works on a bucket milker, you know, because I'm bucket milking. I don't pipeline. So, and just to see how does a bulk tank work. I didn't have any of that. Even though I had two dairy farmers as grandparents, I didn't know. So everything was learning for me. And if I can teach people that or show them that, just so they have an idea, or and I'll let them put it on or whatever, you know, or even hand milking. How do you hand milk? You know, I'll teach them that too, you know. So and the more people that do it, the more expansion we're going to have with people doing it, I believe.
It's amazing the sense of accomplishment that folks get when they can actually draw milk out of an udder.
Yes, it's not easy, is
It is
it?
not easy, and it's all a feel thing. And once you've got the feel, you don't really forget how to do
Well,
that. And you like it's like a it's a neat skill to have.
so my mother, who was a dairy girl, she said, "Oh my God, I haven't milked a cow in 60 years." I'm like, "Can I milk her?" I'm like, "Yeah." And she's there pulling the teat. I'm like, "What are you doing?"
Maybe you do forget how to do it. I don't know.
Yeah, you do forget. Like, "No, Mom, you have to, you know, work your fingers down, you know."
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it took her a minute.
That's how
Then she was
everybody
like,
comes at it, right? They're like, oh, cool. You just
"Yeah, you just pull it, you know." And I'm
them.
like, "You're gonna get kicked."
They will.
And I do highly recommend the anti-kick that goes over the back that you crank. It's the best $150 you're ever gonna spend because it's like putting on your bee suit. It gives you so much confidence that you're not gonna get kicked.
It kind of ruins your day when you get a kick,
Yeah,
right?
or I kicked over the bucket and put their foot in it, you know, and you're like, "Oh,
Oh,
all
it's
that work."
the worst. It's
Yes. And we've all felt it. We've all, and you're gonna have it done, but you know, it just happens, you know.
So
So
your education program, is it in collaboration with any other organization, or is this something you do on your own?
no, the other educational thing we do, we started a farm group called Montachusett Agricultural Alliance, which started with all the ag comms in North Central Mass. All the lead people in that, some weren't, some were, or were on ag comms in different towns and towns around here. They started Farming Beyond Borders, and then it kind of spilled over about 3 years ago into a group of farmers getting together, organizing the farmers, because that's something people don't get together anymore. The farmers used to meet after church in a barn, whatever, and the men used to discuss things and whatever. We don't have that because most people are working outside the house, or at least one person's working outside the house, or the other person's running the kids to games or whatever. So we don't coordinate and talk anymore. So that was kind of the idea. And then it went into trainings. Like, we got involved with local food works growing places, which is sort of like a food hub. It's not a food hub, that's not what they call it. But they started buying vegetables from all the vegetable gardeners, and they didn't care. I don't care if you have, a basket of squash, we'll buy it. I don't care if you have, cucumbers. At least if it's a box of cucumbers, we'll buy them. And their whole mission is to change the way North Central Mass eats, because we are a food desert. We have Winchington, who has no grocery store. We have Fitchburg, Gardner, Winchington, who are, this whole area is the sickest region and the most food insecure due to the poorness of our food here. And that's what kickstarted them to create this whole new thing. They have a process center, which Montachusett Agriculture, MA, is coordinating the farmers doing crop planning. So we're all not growing tomatoes. I grow celery and leeks for them. Those are the two crops I can grow because I have all the compost I want. They're nitrogen lovers, and I can grow a bunch of them in a small area.
And so there's a central place where folks can go to buy all of this produce.
Yes, so growing places, local food works, that's kind of under their, local food works is the under their umbrella, I guess I'd call it. They do the distribution of it. They do farmers markets, they do food boxes that are given to the underserved people. They go to senior centers. They're starting to sell to institutions like hospitals and schools. And they're buying their vegetables from the 27 communities that make up North Central Mass. And they got a grant for that. And that's what was in the grant, that's coming from this one region. They do go outside a little bit, beyond it, because there's farms that want to be part of it, and they don't exclude anyone. And but they focus on the small farmer, the homesteader, the one trying to struggle to make it. They don't have, they're not going into Boston to do the markets because they can't do it, because they just don't have the time.
Right.
So they do, they set up farmers market. Like, they run the Fitchburg, they run the Leominster. So they go to, and they go to a few others too, and they also, they work with other, they got other partners in this, like HEAL and the Community Foundation. They got people that they all work with. And they got us grants to get high tunnels so we can upscale our production, make it longer season, And we got another small little grants coming out, so they've been doing all that for the North Central region. Because we are ignored, because we're all small. There's a few larger farms, but very few.
So, since you meet folks who are just coming into homesteading or small farming, what kind of advice do you give those folks?
Start small. Don't try to do everything at once because you're almost setting yourself up for failure. Start, you bring in, you do one thing, you get it under control, then bring in another and do it that way. That's what I learned. If you try to bring in too much at once, if you try to bring in, like, everyone usually starts with chickens. That's just how it happens. And then now, and then, then they'll bring in, or they'll say, oh, I'm gonna get chickens and pigs, Now you're trying to figure out two things and you're trying to learn about them. It's much easier to learn about it and then move forward. It's the same with, and that's part of, Montechusa agriculture. Don't try to bring in everything. Start slow. They're not expecting you to grow, whether you're doing it for backyard. We do education. So, like, we have, speakers come in and teach you about what you can do about the climate change in your garden so that your plants are getting water, even though you think they're not. There's things you can add, and they're all natural. They're not chemically based. So, like, humates and azomites and that, all that stuff that makes your stuff so much better. That's so depleted in our soils. And that's what we train about in that. And also, we help each other. Like, I'll get phone calls whenever, someone's having a difficult birth, whatever. Do you have this? Do you have that? I've even called for help. We all coordinate and we all help each other. That's one great thing about it. And anybody's welcome to join it. We usually meet the second Sundays of the month. It's usually 2 to 4:30, and we have about 30 farmers that show up every single. We have about a mailing list of 60, but 30 show up usually every month.
That's amazing. Yep, that's a running theme to everyone I've spoken with has had the same experience that the farming community is like a family, like an extended family, and everybody shows up for each other, which is fantastic.
It is. And even though you think you don't need it, you do. Because there's always something you don't know that somebody else knows, And that is one of the things. And most farmers are willing to share that if you know where to go to get it,
Right. Yeah, that's been our experience right from the beginning too, that everyone's happy to share. Everyone's super busy and still somehow manages to take a minute to share that knowledge.
And that's something we all need to do. I mean, it's something that's important, especially as an older farmer, that I have more knowledge than the younger farmers. I can say I did it that way. It didn't work for me. You can try it, but this is what I found worked better, and you might find a better way, but that way did not work,
I don't know of any other industry that works like that.
I don't either. The one thing we need to take out of it, though, is, like, that's one thing about Montechusa Agriculture Alliance. We always say we're not competition. We're all there to support. That's it.
Everybody's got to eat.
Everybody's gonna eat. There's plenty out there for everyone. And it's not competition. And farming always was competition to some of the ag people. And it's not, because there's plenty of people out there that will buy your products.
Absolutely. So we're coming down to the end. So I have a fun question for you.
Okay.
If you could invite any three historical or living people to dinner on your farm, who would they be and why?
It would be Temple Grandin. That's the one person that amazes me,
Yeah.
to overcome autism and to relate to animals the way she does. I don't think a lot of people know Adam's slaughterhouses use her system.
Yeah.
And it's a more comforting system for your animals. And it's a more, so they feel at home. They don't feel like they're alone or panicked or whatever, And she's just an amazing, amazing woman. to relate with animals because you have goats, you know, they all have their own personality. And they all have, yeah, and they all have their own quirkiness, and they all have, you know, they're just like people. They're no different. They don't talk in our language. Our language. They talk when you wean, though.
They sure do. Oh, yeah, those babies sure do, don't they? They're like, oh, I don't really like this very much.
Where's my mama? Yeah. Yeah, so that would be one person I would love to sit down and have dinner with. My other person would be Elwood Quinn. He's up in Canada, and he was the director at one time of Rare Breeds Canada. So he has a lot of stories, and they have a big Quinn farm up there, and he went from this little backyard farm to this giant producing farm, and the stories he's got are incredible. And I've never really sat down with him for a dinner and for any length of time. It's always been little things about rare breeds. So
That
he
sounds.
would be another one I would love to pick his brain.
Yeah. Great. And so I'll have links down in the show notes for folks if they want to check you out or any of the resources that you've mentioned today.
Okay.
Jody, it was so nice talking to you today. Thanks for making time. I know you're busy.
Thank you for having me.
This episode of the Massachusetts Farm to Table podcast is brought to you by Renaissance Farms Permaculture and the shop at Renaissance Farms. Please visit them online, and while you're there, sign up for the weekly newsletter and get 15% off your next order from the shop. Each edition of the newsletter includes farm news, articles, recipes, and updates on upcoming classes, courses, workshops, and special events. Subscribers also receive exclusive subscriber-only discounts each week. Links are in the show notes. Thank you for joining us on another delicious journey through the Massachusetts Farm to Table podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review us on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to follow us on social media and join our Facebook group where you can join the local farm-to-table movement. Links are in the show notes. If you have any questions, feedback, or suggestions for future guests, we'd love to hear from you. Please drop us a line at massachusettsfarmtotable@gmail.com. Until next time, remember to eat local, support your farmers, and keep the farm-to-table movement moving. Thanks for listening.